Zimbabwe, 1994. 62 children are out in the schoolyard on mid-morning recess at Ariel Primary School in the small town of Ruwa. Something is about to happen. A student named Haley says her attention was first drawn to a strange sound, comparing it to someone blowing a flute. Some kids reported that it was a buzzing sound, comparing it to bees or electricity. Something blindingly bright appears in the sky, above a rocky cliff. A girl named Candace said, "We got closer and closer and we saw this silver thing, just shining. We thought it was just a house with glass reflecting in the sun and shining. Then we thought, no, it can't be that, because there's no houses up there on the rocks." The object lands in the schoolyard. It resolves itself into the shape of an oval craft. The object was described as large and silver with lights and a red strip around the edge. Several children see a humanoid figure emerge and stand guard on top of the craft. Another comes running toward them. A student described the figure's running as bouncy, as if a human would run on the moon. Others described it as if he was running in slow motion. In later interviews, as an adult, a woman known as Claire said that the figure was running in slow motion diagonally down the field, and then suddenly, it would reappear in the corner where it started and do the same thing, and then it would reappear and do the same thing, and that was frightening. More frightening than seeing what these things actually were. One kid, Francis, said there were three beings. Two of them were in the line of sight of the craft, and one of them was darting from the class toward the swimming pool, which was 200 to 400 meters from the playground. Similarly to Claire, he described the movement as disappearing and appearing a few meters ahead of itself. The children reported that beings wore shiny, tight-fitting black suits. They had very thin arms and legs and were about 4 feet tall in height. Some children drew the beings without hair. Others drew depictions of them having long, straight black hair and facial features that look like the alien archetype you know and love, known to the UFO people as greys. When the figure finally stopped in front of the children, many of them were entranced by its eyes, described as big, black, shiny pools that they could not look away from. One student said, "It looked evil because it was just staring at me, as if it wanted to come and take us." One female student said she could not see their faces as they appeared blank like a piece of paper to her. While the figure did not speak, several of the kids who stared into its eyes said they received telepathic messages into their mind regarding something that's going to happen. Something big. Something terrible. When asked in later interviews what the message was, the kids had different answers but the same consistent theme. One boy said pollution. Another said, "They want people to know that we're actually making harm on this world, and we mustn't get too technologed." Another student said it was like in the world all the trees would just go down and there would be no air and people would be dying. I think that in space there's no love and down here there is. Other kids said that they were visited because, quote, they were young and that something was going to happen to the earth when we were older. This event changed the lives of these 62 children. It's arguably the best corroborated and most consistent mass UFO sighting of all time. Something happened here. But what? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Zimbabwe, 1994. The country as we know it is 14 years old. Until 1980, it was ruled by its white minority and known first as Southern Rhodesia, then when neighboring Northern Rhodesia transitioned to majority rule in 1964, becoming Zambia, Southern Rhodesia continued on as the only Rhodesia. As you'll know if you're a good Tor's Cabinet viewer, Zambia has its own wild space-related story, but that's not what we're talking about here. Rhodesia kept encouraging white settlement from Europe and America through the 1970s, all while they fought a decade-long civil war with their black majority, finally drawn to a close with an agreement in 1979. White Zimbabweans, who owned most of the country's land, had their farms bought out in a land reform process that left some of them richer than they had been before. Across the 1980s, about two-thirds of white Zimbabweans left, mostly to South Africa, still under apartheid. Poverty and tribal conflict increased among the black majority and was only beginning to subside by the early 1990s. Despite land reform, white Zimbabweans still owned most of Zimbabwe's farmland in 1994. Protests sporadically flickered across the country against President Robert Mugabe and his corrupt party, the ZANU-PF, now believed to be rigging elections. In the 2000s, Mugabe would institute a much more aggressive, poorly handled campaign of land reform, which ended up crashing the economy and causing one of the world's worst periods of hyperinflation, in which ATMs crashed because they weren't built to handle such high numbers, and a 100 trillion Zimbabwean dollar bill was printed, then rapidly became worth more as waste paper than as currency. This is still probably the main thing Zimbabwe is known for in the West. They got rid of the Zimbabwe dollar in 2009, but Mugabe would end up staying in power until he was finally taken out in a coup in 2017. Zimbabweans now often see the 1990s as a golden age. The economy was improving, poverty was declining. It seemed like majority rule was paying dividends at last. Zimbabwe now had well-off black businessmen too, some of whom sent their kids to this elite private school in Ruwa, officially mixed race but still white-dominated, where, on September 16, 1994, something happened. The encounter with the beings only lasted about 15 minutes. At the 10:15 a.m. recess, no adults were present as the teachers were inside at a staff meeting. Under the traditional British boarding school system, which, if you're American, you'll know from Harry Potter, older kids served as prefects to monitor the younger kids. The only adult in the general vicinity was a woman volunteering to run the snack shop. One of the children ran to her and said that a, quote, little man had landed. Other children came running to the school to inform the teachers. One teacher remarked that they came running up in such a panic, and even if they'd staged it, they could not have run all together like that. Another teacher said that, I believed them, that they'd seen something, but I wasn't prepared to accept that it was anything supernatural or anything like that. However, the students remained firm in what they had encountered at their recess. Colin Mackey, Ariel's headmaster, said that he didn't think an imaginative child created a story that convinced the other kids of the event. Rather, quote, I don't believe that I don't believe. I honestly believe they saw something, but for me to draw a conclusion as to what it is, I don't think I could do that at this point in time. In an interview with Dutch TV anchor Tineke de Nooi for the series Tineke and the Paranormal World, the kids said that many of them had dreams about the incident afterwards. They said it was in a bad way. One child spoke about how she dreamt about it for a year, but then she suddenly stopped dreaming about it. The same child also dreamed that the alien had later abducted her from her bed. Some of the kids seemed to have had symptoms of PTSD from the incident. Not all of them, though. One male student said that he, quote, wasn't scared a bit. It was all fun to me. Even though many of the students were terrified, none of the kids said they wished it hadn't happened. They felt privileged to have the visit and wanted to see the aliens again, but closer. Local Zimbabwean UFO researcher Cynthia Hind interviewed the children and found their backgrounds were varied and diverse. Though they all came from privileged families, as the tuition was expensive, they were both black and white. All of them described the features of the figures and the UFO similarly, despite different upbringings. There wasn't even a consensus among the kids that they saw aliens at all. The white kids believed they were aliens, but some of the black kids thought the beings could have been Zvikvambo, which are effectively zombies, or Tokloshe, goblin or fairy-like creatures that appear in folklore all across southern Africa. The kids who thought these beings were goblins burst into tears as they feared they would be eaten. One witness, as an adult, said, I could see the little man, about a meter tall, was dressed in a black shiny suit, that he had long black hair and his eyes, which seemed lower on the cheek than our eyes, were large and elongated. The mouth was just a slit, and the ears were hardly discernible. Hind believed that these varying interpretations, that also all had similar drawings and descriptions, brought more credibility to the idea that the children had all seen a similar event. In her view, they had seen something they couldn't describe and attempted to describe it in different ways. Then again, she was herself a UFO enthusiast. She clearly wanted to believe. It was Hind's review and documentation of the UFO encounter that drew the awareness of John E. Mack, a Harvard psychiatrist. Hind saw Mack as, quote, open-minded and prepared to listen, but an academic of some standing. He was ready to believe the kids had seen something truly extraordinary, ready to risk his job for it. John E. Mack was the head of the psychiatry department at Harvard Medical School from 1977 to his death in 2004. He wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book in 1977 on Lawrence of Arabia, A Prince of Our Disorder, The Life of T.E. Lawrence. He began researching alien abductions in the early 1990s. Initially, he thought that people who claimed to be abducted by aliens were mentally ill, but over time he found that he couldn't convince himself all these stories were false. In 1994, before hearing about Ariel School, he wrote the book Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens. One of Mack's peers, Paul McHugh, at Johns Hopkins Medical School, saw Mack as a brilliant fellow who occasionally loses it, and this time he lost it big time. Originally, Mack had planned to do a book on African alien encounters and abductions in general, but when he heard about the Ariel School, he focused on that. He did not necessarily say that they encountered aliens. He said they encountered something. This is an important detail to remember about John E. Mack. He believed in alien abductions. He did not necessarily believe in aliens. He did not believe that there were physical beings traveling to Earth from other planets in spacecraft. He saw alien abductions as a psychological phenomenon. Okay, so did he think it was mass hysteria? Did he think it was all in their heads? No. Mack believed that alien abductions were spiritual transcendent experiences. He compared them to Native American vision quests and medieval monks having visions of God. Having visions of some greater cause, purpose, or being, often with a motivating message of protecting humanity or nature, just like in the Ariel School case, seems to be a relatively common thing that happens to people. People who take drugs like DMT sometimes encounter beings that feel so real they refuse to believe they didn't literally encounter some extra-dimensional spirit. DMT famously makes people see entities nicknamed machine elves, and while I've never gotten an explanation of what the so-called machine elves look like or act like that makes sense to me, and I'm not sure it can be described in conventional terms, machine elves sounds like a decent description of the entities the Ariel School kids met. In fact, a lot of the details of the Ariel School encounter sound like a psychedelic experience, starting with a buzzing and shimmering in the air, the entities moving in some impossible to describe way where they were running forward but repeatedly teleporting back to where they were, and of course receiving some seemingly deeply meaningful message about protecting the world. People on psychedelics are very suggestible. Hallucinations can be guided by others, so it wouldn't surprise me too much if all the kids had roughly similar stories. I'm not sure if anyone's investigated this potential explanation, and for the record, I don't think it's true. There's this fungus that sometimes grows on wheat called ergot that is chemically similar to LSD and produces hallucinations, to the point that sometimes it's been blamed for the Salem witch trials, but I highly doubt these kids had ergot poisoning. I've never heard of someone having a hallucination this detailed or this not necessarily bad from ergot. I don't know of a way 62 kids could accidentally have been poisoned with something that had psychedelic effects. Anyway, John E. Mack noted that one of the most consistent cultural universals is reported contact with some kind of higher being. The modern Western equivalent of that, he thought, seems to be alien abduction. If people have stories like these the world over, do these higher beings exist? Mack said it's worth studying, at least. The fact that Mack did caused Harvard to investigate him, the school's first ever investigation of a tenured professor. Harvard convened a special faculty committee, chaired by Dr. Arnold S. Relman, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and an appointee to the Massachusetts State Board of Medical Examiners. Other panel members included Harvard's legal counsel and the associate dean of the medical school. According to Daniel Sheehan, Mack's legal counsel, the committee had written its draft report of its findings of fact against Dr. Mack before Dr. Mack was ever informed of any specific accusations of misconduct. The draft report was never released to the public, but Sheehan summarized it, saying it finds that it is professionally irresponsible for any academic, scholar, or practicing psychiatrist to give any credence whatsoever to any personal report of a direct personal contact between a human being and an extraterrestrial being until after the person has been subjected to every possible available battery of standard psychological tests which might conceivably explain the report as the product of some known form of clinical psychosis. To communicate, in any way whatsoever, to a person who has reported a close encounter with an extraterrestrial life form that this experience might well have been real is professionally irresponsible. the committee makes a specific finding that such conduct on the part of Dr. John Mack was in violation of the standards of conduct expected of a member of the faculty of Harvard University. Again, Mack did not necessarily believe in extraterrestrial life forms. Mack was eventually cleared of any wrongdoing, but he never got over his sense of betrayal from his colleagues and Harvard. He spent the remaining years of his life speaking and writing about UFOs and other spiritual experiences, which he categorized as all roughly the same thing, before being suddenly killed by a drunk driver in 2004. Skeptics state a variety of reasons to discredit the children's encounters. 2 days before the incident, the Zenit 2 rocket, used to launch a Russian satellite, had begun its re-entry, falling back to Earth, causing a fireball in the sky over the southern hemisphere. Zimbabwean radio at the time was heavily hit by calls saying they saw a UFO. Demobili Kotoda, who wrote a paper for the Malawi Medical Journal titled Episodes of Mass Hysteria in African Schools, a Study of Literature, found that this was a simple case of mass hysteria and, quote, time should not be wasted in a fruitless search for environmental precipitants, which by reinforcing behavior may serve to prolong these episodes. In other words, mass hysteria should not be a diagnosis of exclusion after all the physical, chemical, and biological factors have been ruled out. There is, after all, a long history of strange mass hysteria episodes in schools, especially African ones. Look up the Tanganyika laughter epidemic. But this journal article doesn't present any evidence for why this is obviously a case of mass hysteria, and the other cases that are definitely mass hysteria all caught on gradually and lasted days, far more like something is happening to us and we can't stop than we all saw this specific thing at this specific time. Skeptics also pointed out that the kids could have been influenced by TV programs and movies. Cynthia Hind remarked that a lot of these kids don't go to the movies. They live in the country. Parents are farmers. This casts some doubt on Hind's general credibility, I think, since it's obviously not true. All the news coverage consistently identifies Ariel School as an elite private school. At the beginning, some of the kids' reports mentioned the entities running towards the swimming pool. Do you think your average elementary school in Zimbabwe has a swimming pool? Brian Dunning, of the Skeptoid blog and podcast, noted that Ruwa is a suburb of Harare, a city of millions of people and the capital of Zimbabwe. In 1994, the school still had a majority white student body. Ariel was one of the most expensive private schools around, and the students would have been exposed to movies and TV about aliens. Dunning also didn't like how Mack interviewed the children because he felt that it was filled with heavy baggage of bias and preconceived conclusions on Mack's part. When multiple witnesses see something, they should be interviewed as soon as possible and separately to prevent cross-contamination of the stories. Mack arrived in Zimbabwe 2 months after the encounter, after most of the students had been interviewed many times before, often together. The component of the kids' accounts where the aliens telepathically communicated a message about protecting the Earth only comes from Mack's interviews. None of the interviews before him mention it. Rather, Dunning believes that Mack prompted the kids, suggesting things like, did they give you a message? What was it about? Like, maybe protecting the Earth? Maybe warning about something that'll happen to Earth in the future? That's something aliens do, right? Because that was the sort of thing that was on Mack's mind. By 1994, the Cold War was over, but Mack was still devoted to the anti-nuclear weapons movement and was a strong environmentalist. A decade earlier, he and Carl Sagan had gotten arrested for occupying a nuclear test site in the Nevada desert. Also, Hind's own interview of the kids was criticized by Dunning because she interviewed the children in groups of 2 to 6, while the other kids were allowed to watch and listen to the groups being interviewed. But, okay, if the most sensational elements of the story are made up, they still saw something, right? What did they see? All the attempts at explaining how the 62 students could have seen something normal are arguably weirder than it being aliens. In Oliver D. Smith's review of the Ariel UFO case, he thought that perhaps what the children were talking about seeing was a dust devil, a naturally occurring whirlwind of dust, sort of like a tornado but less destructive. He made a table, which you're looking at now, explaining how some of the less weird features of the kid's story could have been a somewhat unusual type of dust devil. Strong winds, whirring sounds, although not buzzing like bees or electricity, I think, glowing and spinning around. You know, these are explanations for the craft, but not for the entities. Okay, the kids were rich and sheltered and stuff, but Zimbabwe is a dry place, and in 1994 it was in the midst of a drought. They'd definitely seen dust devils before. I've seen dust devils before. In a sufficiently dry area, they're not that rare. I could use this exact same table to explain that the kids saw a fushigi ball. I'd sooner believe that they really did see aliens than that this extraordinary story comes from something as pedestrian as a dust devil. And I don't believe they really did see aliens. Slightly more plausible is the puppet show hypothesis. There's a puppet show hypothesis. A quote-unquote independent researcher and writer in London named Gideon Reed wrote this, and I don't think I believe this either, but it sure is interesting. Apparently, in the 1990s, USAID promoted AIDS awareness campaigns across Southern Africa through every medium they could think of. To reach people who may not be literate and wouldn't have TVs, they launched traveling puppet shows. Gary Friedman, a puppeteer who had worked with Jim Henson, developed puppets that would teach people about AIDS. To make the puppets racially neutral, they settled on making them gray. Puppets Against AIDS would regularly go out to little villages across Southern Africa and perform puppet routines about AIDS prevention, unannounced. Puppets Against AIDS was what this group was called, but puppets may have been a misnomer since these were full-body costumes with people inside them. Wearing these suits, people walked awkwardly, with long strides, as if they were running in slow motion. Sometimes, kids would be scared of them, or even misidentify them as tokloshes, or, in one tantalizing story Reed cites, aliens. Reed shows photos of Gary Friedman's puppets next to pictures drawn by the kids at Ariel School. He does a clever job of pointing out the similarities, but he kinda undermines his credibility by then suggesting that the kids misidentified the puppeteer's white van as the flying saucer the aliens came out of. Again, these kids were rich. They knew what vans were. And nobody has come forward to claim they did this impromptu performance with the kids, nor a reason why they would do this impromptu performance for the kids. And the Ariel School encounter was big news in Zimbabwe. If their goal was to make these kids aware of AIDS, they certainly seem to have failed. It would have been a big publicity coup for Puppets Against AIDS for them to be able to say, "Nope, it's not aliens, it's us. Wanna learn about AIDS?" There are consistent details of the story that are too weird, I think, for it to have been a puppet show. Also, one of the most consistent details is that the beings were small, whereas the people in suits with Puppets Against AIDS, the suits were super tall. If the kids had seen enough TV to recognize what pop culture aliens look like, I also think they'd be able to recognize puppets. None of the kids have recanted their stories. They still all believe what they said as children. It clearly made a lifelong impact on almost all of them. Some of the kids went into social work and environmental protection fields. As to what happened in that playground, skeptics think it was mass hysteria, natural phenomena, or children lying. Yet, all of the children have maintained all throughout their life that something unusual did occur, and they saw something. Most people who've met them believe that they at least think they're telling the truth. It's up to you to decide who you believe, but me and my co-author, Nick, I suppose we want to believe. I don't have a theory, and neither does Nick. There's one more testimony from that day that this video would be incomplete without including. I said none of the kids had recanted their stories. Well, one did. Dallin Vico is one of the 62 students. In the past, he described his own experience of the encounter in terms that roughly line up with the others' stories. But in a Netflix documentary in 2023, he said that he pointed out a shiny rock in the distance and told his classmates it was a UFO. He never expected anyone to believe him and was shocked when the story started spreading. This can't be it, right? It just can't be. I can't imagine this guy convincing 60 other kids that they just had a life-changing close encounter with aliens. They saw something that day. The question, of course, is what?
Take the blame. want to